Hi, and welcome back to Forest of the Future, the podcast series where we explore ideas, challenges, and solutions shaping the future of forests and of society. In today's episode, we will be stepping a little bit outside of the forest itself and into the world of energy policy. Because some of the biggest pressures on forests today don't start in the forestry sector at all. They start at the petrol pump. With oil prices volatile and supply routes like the Strait of Hormuz under pressure, governments around the world are racing to secure their energy supply. And one of the tools many of them are racing for is biofuels, blended into diesel or petrol, often produced from crops like palm oil or soy, sugarcane, maize. That sounds like a climate win, but it can also mean new pressure on forests, on peatlands, and on the communities who depend on them. So the question we are exploring today is, can biofuels really deliver energy security without driving deforestation? And what roles can certification systems like FSC play in making sure that the answer is yes? To guide us through this, I'm joined by Patrick Schroeder. He is a senior research fellow at Chatham House, and his work focuses on bioeconomy and circularity. Many of you may have heard about Chatham House rules, but Chatham House in itself is one of the world's leading independent policy institutes. And Patrick's research looks at how the global push for energy security is reshaping land use around the world. So let's get into it. Patrick, I know that right now you're looking into biofuels and energy production. Why is that so relevant to look into right now?
So this is a new collaboration we're starting with FSC, so very exciting. We're trying to look at, in this context, how international conflict or geopolitics more broadly are affecting forests and ecosystems. That's a link that's not necessarily often very much explored. So it's very topical at the moment where we have an energy crisis. Everybody's talking about problems of, the Strait of Hormuz being blocked, no access, reduced outputs, higher fuel costs. So it's inducing a global energy crisis. And that has implications, knock-on effects on countries and their strategies, how they're trying to deal with that. And there are implications for forests.
And what is it that governments are doing then?
Governments are implementing different strategies, looking at, for example, how to reduce demand to cope with the current shortage, various mechanisms how they can support citizens in coping with the increases in prices, etc. A growing number of countries are looking at using domestic bioresources, how to use biofuels to meet the shortfall they have. A number of countries have oil stockpiles. They've been using these, but we're now actually facing a situation where lots of these stockpiles running out. So we recently had Fatih Birol, head of the International Energy Agency, come to London and Chatham House, and he talked about that we're actually now facing a major critical point now because these stockpiles are now being depleted, but now we're also facing the summertime, so growing demand for aviation fuels, and the crisis in the Middle East is still ongoing. Even if the Strait of Hormuz would open soon, actually the oil crisis will continue. It won't be immediately resolved.
Okay. But what is those strategies? You said that governments are now pivoting in their strategies and that some of them are saying, well, let's reduce our consumption. Are they doing other things? Are they doing things on top of that?
It's interesting or relevant to look back at what happened during the 1970s oil crisis. For example, Brazil then started its ethanol program in order to become less dependent on international oil markets. In this respect, Brazil has been relatively successful in developing a national biofuels economy based on ethanol and sugarcane. And a number of countries are now looking at maybe replicating this. So we see now an enhanced push for the new biofuel mandates. Some of these plans have been in preparation, but everything is now being accelerated, driven by the concern of energy security and lack of access to oil internationally. We see this in countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, India, Thailand, but also in the US and Australia.
I have two follow-up questions on that. One, just for the ones of us who are not majorly well-versed in biofuels, what does that mean? What is a biofuel?
So there's different feedstocks that can be used. Sugarcane to produce ethanol. You could also have, in Europe, you use a lot of rapeseed to produce like E10. You can also have different inputs like grains. In the US, a lot of maize is used for biodiesel. There's also options to use palm oil, for example. So there's sort of different crops. Many of these are food crops. So the question then becomes, what do countries prioritize? At the moment, we see very much countries prioritizing energy security. So the idea behind biofuels, let's say from a climate perspective, is also that you can actually create fuels that have low carbon footprint. So there's an environmental argument or climate argument for some crops, but that's also often not so clear where the, let's say, the greenhouse gases from biofuels are lower compared to oil. And that's where we come to, say, forests and land use change. So one of the, and that's also not a new issue, if there's push for biofuels that leads then to, let's say, deforestation and land conversion to grow crops for biofuel production, then the overall carbon balance might actually be negative.
Ah, because you're removing a lot of CO2 source from the forest.
Yes. Then there's obviously biodiversity impacts and other things as well. So some crops are better than others. And in some cases, it makes sense. But the risk now is, right, with the acceleration, with the drive to achieve domestic energy security, countries see they have control over their own resources, their bioresource, compared to the volatility of the international oil market and the prices. From that perspective, it's now very attractive to shift to biofuels. And so the environmental considerations and food security considerations are probably, in many cases, now put aside. So that's a concern, and that's something that we're trying to look at in more detail to see where are potentially forests at risk, also maybe some of the ways of how these trade-offs can be mitigated.
It sounds like this is a more attractive opportunity for a lot of governments that you mentioned before, especially in the Global South. Why is this more attractive than, for example, trying to push towards electricity instead as an alternative? Is it faster, or why is it this direction that they're moving in?
I think this is like a short-term versus long-term issue. Electrification of transport requires long-term planning, right? You need to develop also additional infrastructure, charging stations especially. So that takes time. It's not necessarily a quick solution, whereas probably increasing biofuel mandates and then ramping up biofuel production, especially in countries where there's already some capacity to do that. For example, India moving up from E20, Indonesia moving from B40 to B50.
Where's the risk involved in that? What is the long-term risk?
So if we look at Indonesia, there's already a gap in terms of what is available, because Indonesia would be looking at palm oil for biofuel production. The various uncertainties involved as well. So the current shortfall biofuel production, how do you make that up? How do you increase production? So there's various ways. You can increase productivity on existing plantations.
That sounds a bit difficult in a palm oil plantation.
Yeah, that's already, in many cases, maxed out. Another option would be potentially to reduce exports, Indonesia being the largest palm oil exporter globally, together with Malaysia, number one and number two. But here, palm oil is used for food in many other countries. So that would then have impacts potentially on other countries. It would enable to have more supplies domestically. Then there's a question here. This kind of makes sense as a strategy if oil prices are high, but you can substitute the reduced kind of export earnings from reducing palm oil exports by offsetting the reduction in paying higher prices on the international oil market. So these are probably considerations. But another option is obviously to shift production into other areas where currently no palm oil is being produced. That could be existing cropland, but it could also mean accelerating deforestation for new palm oil plantations. There's another factor that needs to be considered, especially in 2026. It will be a bad year for palm oil because of the El Nino. El Nino in 2026, there's been some prediction, because it generally creates droughts in Indonesia, Australia. So the expected palm oil output for 2026 is already about 2 million tons less than normally. So you have all these factors and then a push for more palm oil to go into biofuels. It's not a good scenario.
Okay, that is not sounding ideal. Is that a risk on the horizon for deforestation that we're already seeing materialize?
So there are generally risks of deforestation in palm oil. That's an ongoing issue.
That sounds like there's a really big risk around the corner for forests in the world, which, of course, is what we focus on here in FSC and care deeply about. And, of course, we see certification or land use planning and monitoring as potential safeguards for this. So if there was a requirement for certification, for example, that could potentially be a safeguard against deforestation. Is it realistic that these instruments that we have in the toolbox, that they can keep up with the demand surge? Is it realistic that they will have a positive effect?
I think, yeah, they have a positive effect. All the things that you mentioned are really important. If these are also ideally included in policy processes, governments involving these in their land use planning, this will all be useful. But I think the pressures are quite strong now that some of these solutions or mechanisms or safeguards that you can put in place might not be actually applied. This is where, for example, I see like a tension between meeting demand quickly and then expanding biofuel production versus doing it in a way that minimizes trade-offs. If farmers divert their production towards biofuels, so the demand, let's say, for food still maintains. So there's a secondary effect that then leads to indirect land use change and potentially deforestation. People are aware that this is happening, but it's really hard to quantify, and it's really hard to pin down the causal chain. There's potentially other factors as well. So that's been an ongoing issue, really, how to monitor that and how certification can deal with that. But there's other aspects, how trade-offs can be minimized. And it's also an area where FSC is beginning to move into, is how to look into the use of, let's say, waste streams, residues that can be then also become part of certification. There's another area where certification can actually do more than it does already on actually how to account for this land use change in certification processes. I think that becomes very difficult. That could be another area to look in going forward. Certification can play an important role, and this is to distinguish and have criteria on, okay, what are residues, what are byproducts, what are primary products. And that's an evolving area. Just in the specific case of palm oil, for example, there's the byproduct palm oil mill effluent that's been used for biofuel production. So a lot of it was exported from Indonesia to Europe, although Indonesia now also stopped those exports. There's been issues where palm oil was classified as the palm oil mill effluent. Basically, the primary product was sold as a residue. So here there's a role for certification to make clear and also certify this is a residue versus something else.
Ah, so you really make sure that what could have been sold as food does not inadvertently end up in biofuel production because you think it's actually a residue.
Exactly. Really important going forward. I think it's still important to take this long-term, bigger perspective. It's also important for governments to do that, to have not just be reactive to oil shocks and immediate problems, but governments also need to look at long-term planning, long-term strategies for how they manage not only forests, but broader ecosystems and climate and energy transitions. So that's where you probably can also see the value of FSC membership and other certification work to think through how this could work in practice, also how this could inform then policy. Without policy and actually a proactive role of governments, this is unlikely to work. So governments cannot just think FSC is doing this, so we don't need to take action.
Okay. If we then imagine a world where Hormuz opens up again and oil production has been stabilized, how easy would it be for them to go back if they push now for more biofuels? If they end up changing the ratio, can they then go back easily? Or is this like now this is the easier choice, this is the safer choice? Because we never know when the next oil crisis will hit.
It's a good question, because a lot of the biofuels, including previous mandate, did depend a lot also on government subsidies into the sector. The economics of that will be important. Government can always go back on it, although you would then have let's say, companies and agribusiness that has probably invested into increased biofuel production, who would then be a stakeholder that also has an influence on policy decisions.
Yeah.
And then again, there's also the other development that we see around electrification. So accelerated electrification then of the medium to long term might also then impact the viability of the biofuel mandates, et cetera. The other aspect is the sustainable aviation fuels. So where you won't see any electrification soon. So that's also something we see countries looking into. So that's probably the long-term pathway for biofuels and into that direction.
I'm thinking that maybe we could get a bit more concrete here, because I know that you've looked a lot at the different countries in the world and what they're doing. So if we were to look at a world map today, what are the main hotspots? I mean, we talked briefly about Indonesia and their biodiesel mandate based on palm oil. We touched very briefly on Brazil's ethanol expansion. I know you've also looked into India and their blending program and into the US renewable fuel standard. And I'm just guessing that these are quite different cases with quite different pathways. Do they have the same kind of risks, or does the risks differ as well?
Different countries have different pathways, also depending on different crops. The risks are different for the countries as well. So we talked about deforestation risk in Indonesia, and we think that's a heightened risk now in the push for higher blending mandates. And the risk for India, for example, is probably slightly different, probably more related to food insecurity. India's strategy has been mostly based on also sugarcane ethanol, but I recently listened to a podcast where there was also the discussion that there's a risk that rice increasingly is used also for biofuels. So currently, India has a surplus in rice production. It's a potential source also for biofuels, especially if other crops cannot be expanded so quickly. So it's important also to understand that the risks are not only country-specific, but there's an interlinked risk. Indonesia exports palm oil used in India as food. So if Indonesia were to reduce palm oil exports for domestic biofuel use, that could potentially increase food insecurity in India, especially if domestic Indian policy would also drive the use of rice for the biofuel production. So you could see how individual policy decisions on their own might not be actually that problematic, but they have these unintended effects. So that's kind of something that we're trying to also understand a little bit more with this paper. The US is also expanding biofuel production. There's new mandates put out by the EPA. The US is mainly looking at also exporting fuel feedstock. So Europe is beginning to import biofuel from the US. At the same time, discussion in Australia is going towards reducing exports of canola to Europe, which is used for biodiesel in Europe. So increasingly, countries are beginning to look at export restrictions as part of a way to use resources that are previously traded internationally to boost domestic energy security and meet those mandates that they're putting in place.
It seems like the resilience pivot that we're seeing in almost all policy spaces is also peeking its head out here, making sure that every single region, every single country can sort of fend for themselves. Now that we've looked at all of these different pathways of all of these different approaches from different governments, focusing on different crops, different strategies, are there some that is getting it more right than others, or where some that have elements of where you're thinking, they're actually doing it pretty well?
Yeah, generally speaking, the Brazilian experience, there's many lessons that, or many things that have been done right. That doesn't necessarily mean these can be replicated in other countries. It's very often very country specific where the solutions need to be found.
And what is it that they did right?
First of all, I'd say it's probably the use of what you use as feedstock. Sugarcane ethanol, and let's say also byproducts like molasses from ethanol, from sugarcane, all of that I think is reasonably safe, let's say, also with less trade-offs. But it's also because Brazil's biofuel industry has developed over time. So it's already a long-term experience. So trying to replicate things like that in a short time is maybe also one of the challenges.
Maybe if we return back to Indonesia, because that's where you pointed to risk of deforestation. And of course, that's of particular interest to the listeners of this podcast. Now that they're moving from B40 to B50, so moving from having 40% potential bio-based input to having 50%, and that pushing towards potential land use change, potential deforestation, is there anything that shift from B40 to B50 could come with? Any safeguards or anything that could have been done or can still be done to counterbalance that risk of deforestation and ecosystem loss?
Yes, there are potential safeguards that could be put in place. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's easy to say from a research perspective that these would be important. With this landing mandate update, there should be provisions that this should not contribute to expansion into forests or peatlands. That could be a government policy to be put in place. But then again, the question is, how would that be enforced on local level? So a second safeguard would be verified productivity plan for existing smallholders and industrial plantations. And this is again where certification schemes like FSC, the Roundtable for Sustainable Palm Oil, all the various criteria and methods we already know, they could play a role in this as well. And then the third safeguard could focus on, let's say, limits or a cap on palm oil that's diverted from currently providing food towards biofuels. And that has then also implications for the other issues that I mentioned before, also like the export restrictions, all of that. But again, this is easy to say.
Yeah. I'm thinking, is that realistic?
These safeguards, whether it's realistic that they will be implemented or not. So it's important to point these out. Mm-hmm. In Indonesia, there are stakeholders that are also concerned about these issues. These perspectives also need to be considered in the policy making. Mm-hmm. And in the long term, many of these safeguards absolutely make sense. It is, again, the question how current pressures can be mitigated by long-term planning.
And how far along is that decision for a mandate?
These mandates are, some of these have been in preparation and they're being fast-tracked. But how these will play out, this is a matter of actually implementation over the next few months or the next year. So there are, this is kind of like the time actually where then also pathways are being set for the next years to come.
Hmm. And do you see a role for certification schemes like FSC in this interim or in the longer term, of course, as well, of potentially having a positive impact here? Is there anything that we could do as an organization, that our members could do, that our stakeholders could do to make sure that this does not have the negative consequences that it could potentially have?
Yeah, I think absolutely. FSC as an organization has significant influence, significant also impact internationally. So any recommendations from FSC, from FSC members on how to solve this conundrum, these tricky issues, I think all that would be very valuable for national and local governments, but also businesses that are involved in biofuel development, in forestry. So there's, I think, important role to play for FSC as, say, a transnational network. Mm-hmm. Because through your membership, FSC also has a good overview of what's happening across different countries, how your network can draw on the expertise. All of that would be very valuable.
Hmm. And I guess this is where your upcoming paper will also help FSC get some sort of pointers on where we should focus our energy and what kind of safeguards we could recommend.
Yes, I hope so. Yeah, I hope we can also contribute to this ongoing discussion. Yeah.
And if we then look a bit longer term, because biofuels are not going away, I'd love to explore the role of certification schemes versus governments. Is there a role where this is something that FSC or other certification schemes should cover, and this is something that is the role for politicians, like, for example, deciding we're not going to accept land use change?
The role of certification versus policy, I think it's not a dichotomy. So these can actually support each other. Let's say certification does a lot of the technical groundwork that can be then also used by policymakers to make better decisions on what constitutes a more sustainable option, can also inform public procurement decisions. So I see the certification and actually policy mutually reinforcing. What policymakers probably shouldn't do is say, oh, this is their certification, which is voluntary certification, because that's happening. We don't need to have specific policies in place. So it can be used as the basis to also develop a policy agenda, and then basically by doing that, raise the standards across the whole industry, not only for the companies that are being certified.
Ah, so what you're actually saying is that it's really important that policy still points to votes, that these are our safeguards, and you might implement those safeguards using certification. And these are the certification schemes that could help you do that. And we then, as certification schemes, provide that safeguard on the ground in the actual implementation.
I think so. That's a good way forward, a good collaborative effort between us all.
Are you seeing this in some of the bioeconomy strategies around the world, if we're zooming out? Are you actually seeing this panning out? And what does this whole shift that's happening right now actually tell us about the national bioeconomy strategies more broadly? Are some countries treating bioeconomy as energy security or a tool for that first and foremost, and only then thinking about biodiversity and food security and land use second? Or how is this whole energy crisis actually impacting the bioeconomy strategies?
So with the bioeconomy strategies, this is something we've analyzed in the past, together also with circular economy strategies. And one thing that we've found out is that these are actually not very well connected. So these are different policy domains, also okay. Different ministries driving these different strategies. We've been trying to highlight actually that it makes a lot of sense to integrate these more directly, right? Because a circular economy entails also a shift towards more bio-based resources. In bioeconomy strategies, we see a lot of issues. Bioeconomy strategies are not necessarily more sustainable, but integrating circularity, including the use of waste streams, residues, byproducts, that's one part, but also cascading use of bioresources. But integrating this more directly, you can actually see a lot better outcomes and a minimization of trade-offs. So I guess the current energy crisis exposes some of the weaknesses of national bioeconomy strategies. Biofuels are seen by many countries as the center of their bioeconomy strategies. So it's really a test whether bioeconomy strategies can guide this now in a more sustainable way. So some of the weaknesses of bioeconomy strategies, I guess, is that they're currently lacking some of these guardrails that we talked about on land use, on deforestation. So they've been rather weak on some of these things. So bioeconomies, they can also be a lot more specific on what type of biomass expansion would be acceptable and where it isn't. Also contain more direct forest protection measures. That's maybe something to work on also. And again, where maybe FSC can also contribute, providing advice where bioeconomy strategies can be improved.
Don't you also see, and this might be me leading the witness, but a bioeconomy strategy essentially is dependent on a healthy ecosystem. And right now, ecosystems are under immense pressure because our demand is simply too high. So don't you also see a link between bioeconomy strategies being part of or moving us towards more bio-based societies, and that being part of a solution, but some of it really also has to do with us having to use fibers smarter.
Yes, absolutely. Using fibers in much smarter ways, fibers and materials, which it basically means keeping them in use for longer and keeping them in use at a high value. So we see a lot of fibers being used in very inefficient ways. And that's, again, where the cascading principles come in. So we can do a lot better in maintaining the functionality of fibers, let's say in different applications, thereby reducing the overall throughput that is needed. So that reduces then also upstream pressures. And I think the benefit is also there are new business models that can emerge out of that.
So if you were to give just one simple direct design principle for bioeconomy strategies that would actually work for the forest, for the people, what would that then be? Where would you tell them to focus first?
For bioeconomy strategies, I think they need to be better at distinguishing between different types of bio-based resources. So bring in the circularity thinking, right? Mm-hmm. What are waste-based, residue-based solutions? Ideally, they should be prioritized over, let's say, crop-based biofuels. Then again, this would minimize those trade-offs that we talked about before relating mm-hmm. to food security, land use, etc. What would also be useful, and I don't think bioeconomy strategies have that explicitly, is looking at also the greenhouse gas emissions performance of different biofuels. It's difficult to quantify, but points back again to this indirect land use change. Some of that also needs to be brought into bioeconomy strategies. There's another weakness in bioeconomy strategies that they currently do not provide enough evidence and information, what feedstocks are available for what industries, for what types of purposes. So I think there are many industries competing for the same bioresources. And here you need more national guidance, national strategy to actually determine actually how it can be used, what's the best use for certain resources, rather than having a market-driven approach where this is, again, linked to also international prices.
And I guess the current energy prices really exposes the need for this because the price will go up so much that crops move into biofuels instead of selling it into food.
That's a risk. Hopefully it won't happen, but there needs to be countermeasures actually to avoid these kind of impacts.
So we're coming up towards the end. I know you're working on a paper on all of this to be released. What is the process for the finalization of this paper? Is that something that people could get involved in? What are the hopes for what it does and what it doesn't involve?
It's ongoing work. We're just trying to understand a little bit more. So potentially also trying to quantify how much forest is currently at risk. As we continue to follow the current events, because these policies are updated, I think it's happening on a weekly basis. So we're researching a moving target. But we're keen to hear from people, how are you observing this? Are there any issues that you're observing? Are there specific recommendations you think would be valuable for us to consider and maybe also include in the paper? And obviously, we're happy to engage beyond the actual paper. I think this discussion will continue towards the end of the year. There's a bioeconomy summit coming up held in Dublin later this year. There's also the CBD coming up. So I think these will be quite live discussions taking place at these four.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and hopefully also getting a bit of quantification. That always helps the conversation along. Okay, Patrick, final question. One thing that listeners should take away from this conversation, what should that be?
Maybe one important point is we're at a crucial point with a lot of these new blending mandates and push for biofuels. There's a sense of urgency to solve the current energy crisis, but there's real risk that we create long-term damage to forests and ecosystems. Would encourage everyone to pay a lot of attention to this issue because it's often forgotten. In the news, it's not really right up there, but we need to pay attention to it and try to come up with some solutions to minimize these severe trade-offs that could occur.
Uh-huh. And potentially also use our voices where we can.
And use your voice where you can, yeah. If you have conversations with governments, but also businesses involved in biofuels, these are the key actors that can really determine the direction of this.
That brings us to the end of this episode of Forest for the Future. Today, we looked at how the search for energy security, sharpened by the current oil shock, is pushing governments towards biofuels at speed, and what that could mean for forests, for peatlands, and for food systems if safeguards don't keep up. We talked about indirect land use change, country hotspots like Indonesia, and a very real risk of certification being used as a political shortcut rather than a genuine safeguard. A big thank you to Patrick from Chatham House for sharing his research and for helping us see how energy policy decisions made in capital cities ripple all the way into the forest. For me, the thread running through the conversations is that biofuels are neither a silver bullet nor a villain. It really depends on how they're governed, Mandates without land use guardrails, productivity plans, and credible certification can lock in decades of ecosystem damage for short-term energy effects. But done well, with strong safeguards and honest accounting for indirect land use change, biofuels can be part of a credible energy transition. That's where systems like FSC, alongside RSBO, ISCC, and others have a real role to play. Not as a shortcut, but as a part of the public infrastructure of trust. If you want to dig deeper, I have good news for you. Because Patrick's work will shortly be released in a Chatham House paper focusing on how biofuels can deliver energy security without driving deforestation. And that will go much further into the country cases, policy recommendations that we touched upon today. You can follow the release on the Chatham House website and on FSC.org. If you have enjoyed this episode, make sure that you subscribe to Forest of the Future wherever you get your podcasts. You can also always reach out with recommendations for future episodes or comments for me on podcast@fsc.org. I am Laura Dalgo-Worm, and this was Forest for the Future.